welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, showcasing programs from radio's golden years. I'm your host, Mark Levonier, and this hour, Mystery, later on from The Whistler from 1954. But first, it's the new adventures of Sherlock Holmes with the tale called The Baconian Cipher, a Mutual Broadcasting System episode from May 27th, 1946.
Petri Wine brings you Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce in the new adventures of Sherlock Holmes. The Petri family, the family that took time to bring you good wine, invite you to listen to Dr. Watson tell us another exciting adventure he shared with his old friend, that master detective, Sherlock Holmes. And I want to ask you something. You know, every now and then I've told you about the good old American custom of serving a glass of sherry before dinner, particularly Petri California sherry. And I wonder if you've tried that Petri sherry. Really, a glass of Petri sherry is the best beginning a good meal ever had. Petri sherry is clear, fragrant, and truly delicious. It's a wonderful wine whose flavor is the essence of luscious, sun-ripened grapes. And Petri makes two kinds of sherry wine, a regular sherry and Petri Pale Dry. If you don't know which you prefer, try them both. Don't buy one, buy two. But remember, always buy Petri, because Petri wine is always good wine. Well, I'm sure Dr. Watson's ready for us. Let's go in and join him, shall we?
Come in. Good evening, Mr. Bartell.
Evening, Doctor.
Quiet, Monty. Lie down.
The dogs seem very pleased with themselves tonight. Did they have a good day?
Yes, the three of us did, my boy. Go on, run off out in the patio. I took a 7-iron and some old golf balls on the beach this afternoon. I improved my game, I think, and the dogs had a great time chasing the golf balls. On the way home, the little rascals had a furious battle with an elderly pelican, so their day was complete.
I'll have to join you on one of your afternoon strolls, Doctor. You and the dog seem to have so much fun.
Oh, I'll be glad of your company, Mr. Bartell. Well, draw up your usual chair, and I'll get on with tonight's Sherlock Holmes adventure.
From the hints you gave us last week, I guess a Frenchman played a prominent part in the story?
Yes, indeed he did, Mr. Bartell. His name was François Lavilla, and he was a detective of some note in his own country. The time my story begins, it was in 1889, to be exact. Lavilla had come over to London to discuss with Holmes the difficulties of translating some of his monographs into the French language. At this particular time, I was in the early days of my marriage, Mr. Bartell, and this fact, combined with a busy practice, meant that I saw very little of my old friend.
He must have missed you, Doctor.
Oh, he did. Well, of course, he'd never admit the fact, but to get on with my story. One cloudless June afternoon, I found myself in the neighborhood of Baker Street, and I couldn't resist paying a visit to Holmes. Mrs. Hudson was out, but having retained my old latchkey, I let myself in and mounted the familiar stairs. It gave me a strange feeling as I raised my hand to knock on what once had been my own living room door.
Come in.
Oh, hello, Holmes.
Holmes,
I beg your pardon. I didn't know you were...
Watson, my dear fellow. How very nice to see you again.
It's great to see you, Holmes. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No.
I didn't know that you had company.
Not at all, my dear fellow. We're delighted, aren't we, Lavilla? Watson, this is Monsieur Lavilla.
How do you do, sir?
Enchanté, monsieur. I have often wished to meet so charming Dr. Watson. Holmes has told me a great deal about you.
Oh, it's very nice of you, sir.
Married. Suits you, Watson. You look splendid, old fellow. Gained a little weight, haven't you?
Yes, a few pounds, I mean.
Here comes you. Sit down, won't you?
You sure that I'm not interrupting you in some important discussion?
Oh, no,
mon cher docteur. We were having a good-natured argument on the relative abilities of the French criminal compared to the English.
Oh, interesting.
You must lend me your support, Watson. Monsieur Lavilla is convinced that the English criminal is a very dull dog indeed.
Well, we've met some far from dull ones in our time, I assure you, Monsieur Lavilla.
Ah, the exceptions rather than the rule, I fear, mon cher docteur.
You're stubborn, aren't you, Lavilla?
Believe me, my dear friend, that I will yield to no one in my admiration of your knowledge and skill. That is why I wish I could persuade you to practice in Paris. Ah, there you would find opponents really worthy of your steel. What can happen to interest you in this land of gray fogs, boiled potatoes, and pots of tea?
Excuse me for myself, sir. You're not very flattering.
Oh, don't be so insular, Watson.
Oh, I meant no offense, my friend.
Well, you say that the English criminal is dull. Well, perhaps if you were to read a published story of mine called A Study in Scarlet, you'd think differently. It tells of a very exciting adventure that Holmes and I had.
I have read it, my friend.
Oh, you have?
An extremely gripping story, but surely you will admit that the crime was essentially of American origin.
He's right, Watson. He's perfectly right, dear me. What can I do to vindicate the dishonor of the London criminal? Let me see. Oh, yes, yes, of course. A copy of today's Times. That's fine. I shall introduce you to a section known as the Agony Column. Where is it now? Oh, yes, here we are. This should convince you of the color and variety of English life.
The agony column?
Mm-hmm.
It sounds most painful. What is it, Blake?
A personal column is liable to contain anything from a lover's frantic appeal to his lady love to a ransom note.
In my profession, I've frequently found it an invaluable medium for contacting the underworld. Yes, now, here we are. Here's something. Dear me. Oh, dear, no. Today's column seems rather uninspired, I'm afraid.
May I examine it?
Of course, here you are.
Merci. If the lady who helped my little boy across the road at the corner of Treadwell Street and High Auburn last Wednesday at 4 will get in touch with Box 845, she will learn of something to her advantage. We can be more colorful than that in Paris, my friend.
Yes, I think we can do better than that, too. Yeah, look at this, will you?
The printer must have been half asleep when he set up the type for this advertisement. Will any gentleman interested in discussing cryptography and cipher writing please communicate with Box XQL 696, The Times?
Well, I fail to find this message any more stirring than the preceding one.
You notice the execrable printing, don't you?
Indeed, I do. It is all mixed up. The first word, will, starts with a capital W and a capital I. The second word, any, starts with a small a, and then has a capital N and Y. It is a shocking example of typography.
And when it occurs in a paper noted for its excellence in typesetting, one realizes that this is no mistake.
What do you mean, huh?
This is undoubtedly a code message.
Come now, my friend. I defy even you to make a mystery out of a printer's negligence.
I accept your challenge, my dear Leviar. If you recall, the Baconian bilateral cipher depends upon the use of two sizes of type. If we group the letters in units of five, the arrangements of small and capital letters within the group should give us the message. Now, let's see. Two capitals followed by three small gives us the letter H. Then two capitals, one small, two more. That gives us E, H.
I still think you're trying to make an adventure out of a mere printing accident.
No mere printing accident could so readily fall into one of the great traditional ciphers. Now, let's see. This message reads H, E, L, help, Q, two small, Q, U, I, Quilter, help, Quilter, L, two small and large, Elms, help, Quilter, Elms, there it is, yes. Penge. Help Quilter, Elms Penge.
Help Quilter, Elms Penge. What does that mean?
Presumably that a man named Quilter, who lives at a house called the Elms in the village of Penge, needs help.
Ah, I see it now. A helpless victim held prisoner. He smuggles out this message as a harmless personnel with strict instructions that it be printed on this art form. He knows that the amateurs of cryptography to whom it is addressed will decipher this call for help. Et voilà.
Monsieur Villa, you seem ready to grant that adventure can exist in London after all.
The advantage, my dear Watson, of a more mercurial temperament than we Englishmen possess. Well, Villa, what about it? Shall we set off for Penge and rescue the ingenious Mr. Quilter from whatever dire fate awaits him in the Elms?
I'm all impatience.
Splendid. Watson, I suppose you're too busy to join us.
Too busy?
Well, I mean, your practice, I'm sure that you have patience to attend to.
Oh, yes, of course, yes. As a matter of fact, I have two further visits to make today. One to a peppery old miser who has gout, and the other to a wealthy society woman who has acute attack of hypochondria, as they call it. It blazes with a to hell with both of them. I'm coming with you, Holmes, if you want me.
Bravo, Watson, and grab your hat and coat. The game's afoot.
Here There you are, gents. The helm's pinned. Nice afternoon for a drive, wasn't it? Afraid it'll cost you 15 bob, though.
There's a sovereign for you. You can keep the change.
Lord me, thank you, Governor. Top of the evening to you, gents.
This is the Elms, eh? Quite a bit of land for such a modest neighborhood.
To call it the Elms seemed remarkably inapropos. I cannot see an elm tree in sight.
So you see, Livia, the English have more imagination than you give them credit for.
Are you just going to walk up to the front door and knock, Holmes?
Why not? The direct approach is often the most satisfactory.
Oh, you disappoint me. I had hoped that perhaps you would adopt one of the disguises in which you are so adept, I am told.
Well, since it's unlikely that these people know me by sight, that's hardly necessary, is it? However, I trust that this little problem may reward you with some colorful highlights before we're through. Oh.
Great Scott. Revolver shots. They came from the house.
Ah, we are too late. Mr. Quilter has been murdered.
No, I think not. You will observe that the next-door neighbor to the Elms was mowing his front lawn as we drove up. He is still engaged in the same occupation. Obviously, revolver shots attract little attention in this vicinity.
Mon Dieu, you mean that violence and sudden death are so common that they do not attract even the passing interest?
No, we are. Even the British are not as phlegmatic as that.
Then what is the answer to those shots, Holmes?
Look, some member of this household is addicted to pistol practice. The fact that a shooting target is nailed to the back of that fence over there would further support the theory.
Well, that's rather ominous, in my opinion.
Well, here we are at the front door. Let's keep our wits about us, anyway.
Are you carrying a revolver, Dr. Watson?
No, no stethoscope, I'm afraid. I was prepared for sickness when I left the house today, and not for crime.
I, too, am unarmed. How about you, Monsieur Holmes?
Only a magnifying glass, I'm afraid. Hardly a very lethal weapon.
Yes?
My friends and I were calling on Mr. Coulter.
Oh? Who are you?
My name is Sherlock Holmes, and these are my friends. Dr. Watson and Monsieur Leviat.
How do you do, madam? How do you do?
Is Mr. Quilter expecting?
I don't know. We read his advertisement in the agony column of the Times today and came down here at once. Are you a relation of his?
I'm his niece.
Oh.
My name is Doris Faversham. Come in, won't you?
Miss Faversham, I suppose it is.
Yes, Doctor. It's Miss Faversham.
We heard three revolver shots as we were walking up the driveway. It gave us quite a start.
Yes, mademoiselle. We were afraid that we might have arrived at the time of tragedy.
Yes, indeed.
Tragedy? Oh. My hobby is revolver shooting. I was doing some target practice in the back garden as you arrived.
Revolver shooting, Miss Faversham. How very interesting. I flatter myself that I'm something of a marksman myself.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, perhaps we can have a match. Won't you sit down?
Your challenge intrigues me, Miss Faversham, but before I accept it, I should like to see Mr. Quilter.
Well, Uncle George is paralyzed, you know.
Oh,
spends all his time in a wheelchair. I'm not at all sure he'll see you.
Well, at least you can ask him, can't you, Miss Faversham?
It is his custom at this time of the day to take a little nap. Perhaps tomorrow...
Doris!
He's still awake.
Who's here?
Yes,
Virginia?
Uncle? Some men have come to see you, Uncle.
Well, bring him in.
Follow me, gentlemen. Uncle? This is Mr. Sherlock Holmes, Dr. Watson, and Monsieur...
Leviat.
And Monsieur Leviat.
How do you do, sir?
Sherlock Holmes, eh? It took you long enough to decipher my message and get here, didn't it? Your brother's a much faster worker, isn't he?
Oh, what makes you say that, Mr. Quilter?
Received this telegram from him at 11 o'clock this morning. Read it for yourself.
Oh. Well, what's it say, Holmes?
Suggest you consult my brother, Sherlock, and it's... It's signed Mycroft Holmes. Yes, Mr. Quilter, my brother is a much faster worker. Or shall we say that he suffers from the unfortunate habit of early rising? He undoubtedly read the agony column 3 hours before I did today.
Don't know about that, but I've been expecting you all day. I imagine you know why I inserted that advertisement.
Well, I had the impression that you were under some form of restraint, that you were in need of a rescue party, as it were.
Rubbish. Hmm? My advertisement was a piece of subtle bait. The only person that could decipher the message would obviously be someone who knew the Baconian cipher.
Very logical deduction, Mr. Quilter.
You see, I'm convinced, as any sensible man should be, that the so-called Shakespearean plays were written by Sir Francis Bacon.
Oh, I see.
But I felt that it needed a clever man to prove the fact.
Mm-hmm.
I was sure that anyone who was able to decipher my message was the man I needed. And what'll you take, Mr. Holmes, to do the job? I'm a rich man. Name your fee.
You mean to say that you inveigled Mr. Holmes down here just to do some research... on the origin of Shakespeare's work?
Oh, you needn't look so shocked, Dr. Watson. My uncle has offered to pay him a handsome fee.
Well, what do you say, Mr. Sherlock Holmes?
An interesting subject for research. I'll concede that Ignatius Donnelly and others have proved almost beyond doubt that William Shakespeare of Stratford-on-Avon did not write the plays, but I greatly doubt that Lord Bacon did. I may devote my leisure and later years to some investigation on the subject, but in the meanwhile, Mr. Quilton, I'm afraid I'm much too busy to undertake such an assignment.
Oh, please yourself. Show the gentleman out, Doris.
Goodbye, sir.
Good day, sir.
Too bad you had this long drive down here for nothing, gentlemen.
Yes, I'm afraid I quite agree on it.
It would seem to me that your uncle has a distinct talent for practical joking, mademoiselle.
Uncle? Oh, uncle never made a joke in his life. Mr. Holmes, now that you're here, perhaps you'd like to indulge in a little shooting match.
Thank you, Miss Faversham, but as I told your uncle, I'm a busy man. Good evening to you.
Goodbye, gentlemen.
Goodbye.
Holmes, old fellow, you're losing your touch. You'd never have made a blunder like this if I'd still been with you.
It is comforting for an aspiring detective like myself to know that the great Sherlock Holmes is fallible.
Yes,
Then am I to assume that I must continue the case alone?
What do you mean, continue the case? There isn't one. Quilter's in no danger.
He's in desperate danger.
What?
I'm only afraid I may be too late to save him.
But we have just spoken to the man.
Oh, no. Did neither of you notice the traces of fresh loam on the boots of that supposedly paralyzed man? Gentlemen, I fear the agony column has led us to murder.
You'll hear the rest of Dr. Watson's story in just a second. Time enough for me to mention that any meal is a better meal when it's served with a Petri dinner wine. If you're having chicken or fish, use Petri California Sauterne. Petri Sauterne is a subtle, delicately flavored white wine that looks and tastes like captured sunshine. If you're having a roast or chops or any kind of meat or meat dish, then by all means serve Petri California Burgundy. Petri Burgundy is a hearty, full-flavored red wine, one of the most delicious red wines you ever poured from a bottle. Why not get a bottle of each? Petri Burgundy and Petri Sauterne. Then, no matter what you have for dinner, you'll surely have the right wine, a Petri wine. Well, Doctor, why did you have to break off your story there?
Well, I had to break it off somewhere, Mr. Bartell, and that seemed to be the most exciting spot.
It certainly was. I was convinced that the great Sherlock Holmes had been fooled for once. What happened next?
Well, my boy, needless to remark, we did not get into a cab and go back to London, but let me pick up the story at the same place that I broke it off. As Holmes said...
Gentlemen, I fear the agony column has led us to murder.
Murder?
There was fresh earth on the soles of his boots, you say?
Distinct traces, proving that the man in the wheelchair was not paralyzed.
And that man, whoever he is, was impersonating Quilter to put us off the track.
And the real Quilter may have been killed, eh?
I'm afraid so. Let's stop here for a moment, shall we, while we make our plans. This hedge will hide us from the house in case they're watching from the windows. Now... this isn't a hard picture to reconstruct. There undoubtedly is, or was, a paralyzed Baconian scholar named Quilter. He managed to smuggle out that ingenious plea for help, but Mycroft's unfortunate telegram gave the game away.
Mm-hmm. I see it now. The people in there, holding him prisoner, forced him to reveal what he has done, eh?
What they may have done to him, heaven alone knows.
One of the criminals, guessing from the telegram that I might appear on the case, posed as the crippled Quilter.
What's our next move, Holmes?
Remember that singularly unattractive young lady's skill with the revolver? We must search the grounds as unobtrusively as we can.
Search the grounds? For what?
I can answer that question, Monsieur Docteur. We search for signs of the freshly turned earth of a grave.
Didn't find any traces of the poor devil's corpse, thank heaven.
No. A great disappointment.
Cheer me, you're very bloodthirsty, Livia. Hello. Look at the old fellow trimming the hedge over there.
Must be the gardener.
Let's have a chat with him, shall we? May be able to give us some information. Good evening to you.
Evening to you, gentlemen.
Really?
You work for Mr. Quilter?
That I do, sir. That I do.
Ah, very fine work, too. I've seldom seen a better-kept garden.
Why, thank you, sir. I do pride myself in my work.
I wonder if you can help me.
Be glad to if I can, sir.
Did you see a telegraph boy deliver a message here this morning?
That I did, sir. The boy came here about 10 o'clock this morning. I was a clip in the front edge at the time.
And you've been working here ever since?
Yes, sir. Brought my lunch with me today and ate it in the garden.
Has anyone entered or left the house since that telegram was delivered?
No, sir. No one except yourself.
I see, I see. I suppose you occasionally run errands for Mr. Coulter?
Not much these days, sir. The poor old gentleman keeps his chair in the house pretty much all the time, sir. I did run a message for him yesterday,
oh,
though.
Oh, you did? Where to?
Well, sir, I was pruning the rose bushes under his study windows when the window opens and his hand comes out with a message. He told me to take it to the village office of the Times and to tell him to print it just the way it was. He looked kind of worried when he gave me the message, and he whispered to me, just as if he was afraid in his own house.
I'm much obliged to you. Here's 5 shillings for your trouble.
Oh, thank you, sir. Much obliged to you, I'm sure.
Good evening.
Good evening to you, gentlemen.
Well, so that's how the message was smuggled out.
And no one has come to the house or left it since that telegram was delivered.
Therefore, Coulter or his body must still be inside that house.
We are going to search the house?
Yes, we are.
But we're not armed, and they certainly are. They probably won't even let us in.
Yes, they will. We have an infallible key to entry, a woman's vanity. Come on.
Oh, so you came back. I thought you wouldn't be able to resist my challenge to a pistol match, Mr. Holmes.
Exactly, Miss Faversham. We had difficulty in finding a cab and decided to take a train back to London. It was an hour's wait, so I thought I'd accept your challenge.
Good. Come in. We'll go into the back garden.
Thank you.
Don't talk loudly. I think Uncle's asleep in the next room.
Don't bring anybody in here, Doris. I want to sleep.
All right, Uncle. This way, gentlemen.
If your uncle wants to sleep, seems a funny sort of alibi.
Oh, well, he's used to that, Doctor. Here we are. This is the 50-yard range, Mr. Holmes. 3 shots. Best aggregate score wins. How much do you want to bet?
You name the stake. Name the stakes, Miss Faversham.
A sovereign?
Certainly. You take the first 3 shots?
Very well. I must just check that it's loaded. Yes, 6 bullets. All right, here I go.
Bravo, Miss Faversham. Splendid.
A bullseye and 2 winners. I can do better. Your turn, Mr. Holmes.
Doris, who are these men?
Friends of mine. I'll introduce you in a minute, Geoffrey. We're in the middle of a match at the moment. Your turn, Mr. Holmes.
The revolver, please.
Here you are.
Thank you.
You're sure you know how to handle a revolver?
Oh, quite sure, thanks.
Then why are you pointing it at me?
Because I want you to raise your hands above your head. You too, whatever your name is.
Doris, who are these men?
Put up your hands. I shan't hesitate to shoot, I assure you. Come on. That's it.
What in heaven's name do you think you're up to?
Finding out what became of the real Mr. Quilter. Search the man, Watson.
Right, you are, Holmes.
Go to the house, will you, and search it.
Yes, but of course.
Hello, this man had a revolver on his hip.
Keep him covered with it.
Here, stand still, you.
Now, sir, who are you? From your resemblance to the man in the wheelchair that we saw earlier, I should say that you're a member of the same family.
We're both relatives of Mr. Quilter.
That's right. My name's Davies. I'm from the Australian branch of the family.
Relatives, yes. And doubtless you stood to inherit his estate in the event of Quilter's death. You moved in on this defenseless old man, terrorized him, lived off him, and finally found it necessary to destroy him.
You're talking absolute rubbish.
He's telling the truth, and you know it. I can tell by your expressions.
Move back into the house, both of you. Come on. And keep your hands raised. All right, that's it. Come on. Lead the way into the study. The man posing as Mr. Coulter is still there. We heard him call out as we came in.
Yes, we might as well confront the three of them together. Yes, he's still seated in the chair. He seems to be asleep.
Via! Did you find anything?
Not a trace of the missing men, Monsieur Holmes.
Davies, what did you do with Mr. Coulter?
I didn't do anything with him.
Of course not. He's sitting there in that chair.
Well, it's no good lying to us. We know that man's an imposter.
This is a fantastic situation. Nobody has left this house since the telegram arrived, and nobody has come to it, and yet Mr. Coulter has vanished.
Good Lord, how can he sleep through all this talk? You'd think he'd been drugged.
Via! We're idiots! You are unquestionably the most promising detective in France, and some people have been kind enough to grant me a similar status in England, and yet my old friend Watson has just solved the case.
Oh, well, nothing. Just too happy to... What? Solved it? Well, how?
Listen to the breathing of that man in the chair.
What?
He's been drugged. There sits the real Mr. Quilter. The persecuted victim who sent a cipher message for help.
The man we spoke to earlier.
Was you, Mr. Davies, impersonating Quilter. After you'd received us, you took off your disguise, adopted an Australian accent, and then hid your drug victim by placing him in his own wheelchair, knowing that would be the last place we'd look for him.
And they would have kept him here until we had gone and then murdered him.
What a devilish plot.
Well, what have you got to say for yourselves?
It was Jeffrey's idea, not mine. I didn't have anything to do with it.
That's a dirty lie. You were in this as much as I am.
Oh, this is splendid. Simply splendid. Please continue the argument. It'll make interesting evidence in court.
You can't take us into court.
Of course you can't. What's the charge? Quilter's still alive, isn't he?
When Mr. Quilter revives under Dr. Watson's ministrations, you will be charged, I have no doubt, with attempted murder, abduction, sequestration, duress, and probably several other counts. Monsieur Villard, if you will find us a cab, we'll take these miscreants to Scotland Yard. Our work is done.
Well, Doctor, that was a fine story. What are you fidgeting for?
Fidgeting? I'm expecting a guest. I thought I heard him just now. The front door.
A guest? Now, you're being as mysterious as Mr. Holmes.
Oh, not quite. You see, come in.
Dr. Watson, how are you, you old rat?
Gregory, my boy, it's great to see you again. Mr. Bartell, meet my friend, Mr. Gregory Hood.
Not the Gregory Hood.
Mr. Bartell, I like the way you say that.
Yes, Mr. Bartell, this is the Gregory Hood.
Mr. Bartell, if you listen to Dr. Watson, he'll lead you to believe I'm much more important than I am. I'm quite a simple person, really. I'm kind to dogs, just love little children, and always help old ladies cross the street. I also know how to make a fire by rubbing two sticks together.
Yes, and unlike my old friend Holmes, you pretend to know very little about criminals and crime, and yet you're one of America's outstanding criminologists.
So I've heard.
A hobby, Mr. Bartell, a hobby. My real business is importing, headquarters San Francisco. Need any old masters? Perhaps I can sell you a nice piece of jade, or would you rather have a bit of old Balinese sculpture?
Now, wait a minute. This is all a little too fast for me.
Yes, you learn that Gregory is a little too fast for everybody. But, Mr. Bartell, I'm sure you'll get to know Mr. Hood a good deal better. You see, as I've told you, I've always wanted to take a trip back to England, and now I have a chance to do so.
But, Doctor, won't I see you again? What about our story?
Oh, I shall be back in the fall. But meanwhile, I've asked Mr. Gregory Hood to get together with you at this time every week and tell you some of his experiences.
Which, of course, makes me feel very important.
Mr. Hood, as you know, has been involved in many famous cases dealing in crime. His importing business and his hobby criminology are a strange combination. I learned that he keeps a diary of these cases, and it's a fascinating book. The Case Book of Gregory Hood.
The Case Book of Gregory Hood. Sounds intriguing.
Intriguing? Huh. It certainly is.
Thank you.
Well, then I can tell all our friends, be sure to listen next week at the same time and every Monday night through the summer to The Case Book of Gregory Hood.
The New Adventures of Sherlock Holmes on Tuned to Yesterday from the 27th of May, 1946 on the Mutual Broadcasting System. That would mark Basil Rathbone's final appearance as Sherlock Holmes on radio. The actor felt that he was being typecast or limiting himself from playing other roles. After his radio run since the 1930s and in the 14 motion pictures he co-starred in as Sherlock Holmes, Nigel Bruce was joined by new actor Tom Conway that following fall. Bruce hung on for about a year before he left the series as well. This is an hour of mystery on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Livonier. Now a story from The Whistler called Round Trip Tickets, a CBS radio broadcast from June 6th, 1954.
The Whistler. Presented by the United States Air Forces in Europe.
I am the Whistler, and I know many things, for I walk by night. I know many strange tales, hidden in the hearts of men and women who have stepped into the shadows. Yes, I know the nameless terrors of which they dare not speak.
Main story, Round Trip Tickets.
Standing at the window of the cheap hotel room and looking out over the outline of lights and neon that was Kansas City after sundown, Eve Benton felt a pressing sense of concern. That the condition would pass, she was certain. She'd managed before, she would manage again somewhere. But she wasn't thinking of that now. Eve Benton was being sorry for herself, forgetting her good points, the quiet, restless beauty in her face, the sullen attractiveness of her features. She was annoyed at the city and the world. Her action of raising the window seemed almost a preparation for the voicing of her resentment. But the words never came. Instead, other voices nearby caught her interest.
$30,000, that's the deal.
A lot of money. A lot of money.
Not for the return of the firm and stuff.
$30,000 and no questions asked. That's what the insurance company says.
Yeah, that's what they said.
You smile strangely, don't you, Eve? Listening in ironic amusement. $30,000, one of the men next door said. They're talking in thousands, while you stand so close by, wondering where you'll get the money to pay your hotel bill. You start to close the window when the voices grow suddenly louder and raised in anger.
It won't work. You can't get away with anything like that.
I'll worry about that part. You just worry about this.
Oh!
You freeze to the spot, don't you, Eve? Your outstretched hand touching the windowsill remains fixed and rigid like a statue. And then you hear someone climbing out onto the fire escape. A man is outlined by the staccato flashing of a neon sign on top of the building next door. He hesitates, turns to cast a last glance back at the room he just left. You get a clear look at his face, don't you, Eve? And then he starts down the escape steps. You lean out. See the man drop to the ground and disappear into the shadows of the alley below. You wait, staring. Men run out of your room into the hall. The door to the room next door is partially ajar. You run to it and glance inside. A man on the floor, lying very still. You're about to turn and run when your eyes fasten on something you see. A wallet, isn't it, Eve? Yes. With part of the contents spilled out, a few bills, and among them, a train ticket. Something that you could use. Yes, Eve. A train ticket for the West Coast, San Francisco, and nearly $200 in currency. It's an answer to your problem, isn't it? You lose little time in packing, leaving your room by the same method as the man who fled only a few moments before. The fire escape.
Oh.
Oh, I'm sorry. I startled you?
Well, no. No, it's just that you look like someone I knew.
Now, I have another reason to be sorry that I'm not. You just get on this train?
To Kansas City, yes.
It's an interesting place, huh?
Yes. Yes, it is.
He smiles, doesn't he, Eve? He can even do that. This man who pretends to be so nonchalant, so much at ease. You wonder how he would feel if he knew that you'd recognize him. That you were certain he was the man you saw fleeing from the hotel room next to yours. That you shared his grim secret of murder.
Hey, something wrong?
What?
The way you're staring at me, you said I'm not the guy you thought I was, but is there some other reason?
Oh, no, there isn't anything.
Uh-huh. We're some distance to travel together. There's no reason why we shouldn't become better acquainted now, is there?
No. No, there isn't. No reason at all.
You're unable to avoid the young man sitting across from you, aren't you, Eve? A man who's introduced himself as Frank Gilby. A man you're certain committed a murder in the hotel room next to yours. By the time you reach Oakland and board the ferry boat that will take you to San Francisco, the young man has become quite persistent.
You know, I do think you're trying to avoid me, Miss Benton. Eve, any reason?
No, it's just that I've had things on my mind. I've been thinking about a job.
Well, perhaps I can help you. I know lots of people.
Well, no, I have something waiting for me in the city.
Well, just a thought, huh? In case it doesn't work out, I wish you'd give me your address.
Well, I'm not sure what it will be.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Well, mine's 4950 California Street. I've got a flat there. And I'd really like to see you again.
You want only to rid yourself of the persistent Mr. Gilby, don't you, Eve? Finally, once ashore and in a taxicab, you feel he's no longer a worry. You register at a small hotel on Geary Street. Dismiss him from your thoughts. But late the following morning, as you're having breakfast in a small diner, you're listening to the radio, and something the news announcer says sets you to thinking about Frank again.
Will either increase or decrease during the balance of this year. And in local news, the Perryman jewelry case has reached a stalemate with the valuables still unreturned. According to private investigator Leonard Quinn, a contact with an underworld character in Kansas City failed to take place. It has since been revealed that the insurance company had made a tentative offer of $30,000, with, as we understand, no questions asked for the return of the necklace to Mr. Quinn or to the home of wealthy Mrs. Evans Perryman in Hillsborough. However...
Oh, I wanted to hear that.
Huh? Oh, sorry, lady. The guy was just about through.
What was that name he mentioned? Mrs. Evans, somebody?
Perryman. Mrs. Evans Perryman. Lives down the peninsula.
Perryman, I see.
You were acquainted with the lady?
No. No, but I've heard of the name.
Yes, the words of the newscaster set you thinking, didn't they, Eve? Especially the mention of $30,000. That was the figure you heard Frank Gilby mention in that Kansas City hotel room. Strangely enough, after you've taken a cab to 4950 California Street, walked up the stairs to his flat, you hear the words again.
Yeah.
This time over the transom as Frank talks on the telephone.
Quinn, yeah. Well, that $30,000 of the Perryman deal, you get me the money and you'll get the necklace back. Yeah, that's right. Take a couple of days, the contact's out of town. Yeah, sure, all right. Bye. Yeah?
Oh, Eve. Hello there.
Hello, Frank.
Hey, you changed your mind, huh? I thought you'd look me up after all. Come on in, come on in.
Thank you.
Say, how'd that job go? Is it all set?
Well, no, I didn't go there.
Well, maybe I can help on that, like I said, huh?
I'm sure you can. I'm sure you can help me, Frank.
Yeah, anything at all.
I'm glad you feel that way. Because I'm referring to the Perryman deal, the $30,000 you're going to get from Leonard Quinn and the insurance company.
What?
Mm-hmm. The $30,000 you wanted all for yourself. That's why you killed your partner back there in that Kansas City hotel and took the necklace. I happen to be in the next room.
I see.
You've got a new partner now, Frankie.
Oh, have I?
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't try anything if I were you. I've taken the necessary precautions. Old, but effective. If something happens to me...
Yes, the cops find out about that little accident in KC and they come looking for me, right?
Right.
Uh-huh. Well, looks like I'm sort of behind the eight ball, huh?
Well, you don't have to stay there if you play it right.
Well, that means your way, doesn't it?
My way.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Have you talked with Quinn?
No.
Now, Frankie, I think you have.
Okay, so I talked with him. He thinks I'm just a go-between.
Well, naturally, you wouldn't tell him you'd killed a man to get the necklace. What sort of arrangement you made with him?
Well, he gives me the dough, and a couple of days after I contact the guy with the necklace, I bring it back to him, that's all.
Quinn trusts you that much?
Sure. Yeah, I've handled deals like this before with Mr. Quinn.
When's he going to pay off?
Tonight.
Fine. Well, it's all settled then. I'll meet you here after you've collected from Quinn. What time?
I'll be back by 9.
We'll open a bottle of champagne to celebrate.
I'll buy.
Naturally, it's your party. See you tonight, Frankie. 9.
It was simple, wasn't it, Eve? Easier than you thought. And now you're in partnership with a murderer. A temporary partnership, you tell yourself. And it'll be worth it. $15,000. And that's all you want from Frank Gilby. After it's over, you'll move on, start a new life. Yes, it was all so simple, talking your way into that partnership. But as the day wears on, you begin to wonder about it. Perhaps it was too simple, Eve. You really hadn't expected Frank to accept your demand so readily. The more you think about it, the more certain you become that he'll bear watching. Early that evening, you hurry back to his flat. And as your cab turns into California Street, you see Frank board a cable car.
Oh, driver.
Yes, ma'am.
Don't stop. I've changed my mind. I want you to stay close to that streetcar.
Yes, ma'am.
But not too close.
Okay, I get it.
At Montgomery Street, you watch Frank step into an office building. And sitting in the cab, you wait, keeping your eyes on the entrance. A quarter of an hour goes by, and then he comes out, walks back to the corner, and hops onto a cable car as it starts the climb up the hill.
Driver.
I know. Keep close, but not too close.
Exactly, driver. Close, but not too close.
You know, lady, it ain't none of my business.
You're quite right, driver. It's none of your business.
You follow Frank back to his flat, see him hurry inside. You're quite certain you know what he's up to, aren't you, Eve? But you want more time to think about it alone. So you tell your cab driver to keep going. Finally, an hour later, you return to Frank's place.
Well, hello. You're sort of early, aren't you?
Well, I've changed my mind, Frank. I'd like to go with you when you get the money.
Oh, well, that's been called off.
Called off?
Yeah, postponed, I mean, you know, until tomorrow night. I just got a phone call from Quinn. He said he hadn't had time to get that money from the insurance company yet.
Oh, I see.
Well, sit down, sweetheart.
I was looking forward to that champagne.
Well, now, there's no reason why we can't celebrate in advance. Matter of fact, I was just about to call you.
Well, were you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought we might have dinner together, you know, North Beach, Fisherman's Wharf, maybe.
That sounds interesting.
Yeah? What do you say?
I've always wanted to see Fisherman's Wharf.
Fine, we'll start there then, huh?
All right.
Oh, say, there's a nice little restaurant on Broadway I think you'll like. It's got the best veal scallopini in town.
Oh, I'm sure I'll love it, whatever it is. Frank.
Yeah?
My gloves, I must have left them on the chair.
Oh, sure, I'll get them.
The moment he turns around and steps back into the room, you release the lock on the door. Now you won't need a key, will you, Eve? Then quickly you reach down and tear a hole in your stocking. In a moment, Frank returns.
There we are.
Oh, thanks.
All set.
All set. Oh, dear.
What's the matter?
Oh, will you look at that a run in my stocking? Just look at it.
Ah, yeah. That's quite a run. Nicest one I've seen in a long time.
That's my best pair. You won't mind stopping by my hotel for a moment, will you?
Of course not. Let's go.
At your hotel, you leave Frank waiting in the cab parked at the entrance while you hurry inside the crowded lobby and right on out the door on the other side. You go back to Frank's place. Slip quietly into the apartment. Find what you'd expected. An envelope containing $30,000 in his suitcase. Frank was going to double-cross you after all, wasn't he? Yes, you've proof of that now. You hurry back to your hotel room. You put in a phone call to the railroad station. Check the trains leaving town and make your reservations. As you hang up the receiver...
Yes,
I got to wondering about you, sweetheart.
Oh, Frank, I'm sorry I took so long, but I had a phone call.
Oh?
My brother.
News from home?
Yes, and not too good, I'm afraid. My father's had another attack. I'm terribly worried.
Oh, it's too bad.
Frank, about tonight, I don't feel much like celebrating, you understand.
Oh, sure.
I wouldn't be much company.
Don't give it another thought, baby. We'll have dinner tomorrow night.
All right, Frank. I'm really sorry.
Sure. I'll see you tomorrow, huh?
You watch from your hotel window. See Frank get into the cab and drive away. quickly you pack your things and check out of the hotel. It's 2 hours before your train leaves. Time to have dinner. But first, there's one thing you must do. You've made up your mind about that, haven't you, Eve? From the moment you found the $30,000 in Frank's flat. You step into a phone booth and call the police department.
I want to report a murder, officer. The Alton Hotel in Kansas City 5 days ago. The killer is here in town.
What?
He's arranged a deal with Leonard Quinn, a private investigator.
Anything to do with the Perriman necklace robbery?
Everything. The party I'm talking about took the Perriman necklace off the man who was killed in Kansas City.
Go ahead.
I suggest you contact Mr. Quinn. Get him to tell you who he's made that deal with, and you'll have the killer.
Will you give me your name, ma'am?
No, I won't. Goodbye.
Now you're settled comfortably on the train for Los Angeles. It moves out of the station, rumbles through the outskirts of San Francisco. You lean back and close your eyes. It's been an exciting day, hasn't it, Eve? And as you listen to the rhythmic click of the wheels, you doze off. And then suddenly you're awake again. You're staring at the headlines of the newspaper in the hands of the man sitting opposite you.
Man murdered in Kansas City Hotel, linked by police with theft of Perriman necklace.
A cold wave of fear sweeps over you. Then he lowers the paper.
Hello, sweetheart.
Frank.
Surprised? Switchboard operator at your hotel just couldn't resist a 10-spot.
I see. How stupid of me.
Wasn't very smart of you to walk out with my 30,000, either.
And what were you going to do?
Oh, you got me all wrong, honey. I was going to surprise you.
I'll bet.
Okay. So each of us try to double-cross the other. What do you say we call it even now and split the money between us, huh?
All right, Frank.
Oh, look, we ought to try to get along, huh, sweetheart? You have something on me, but I can make trouble for you if I want to.
Oh, can you?
You're in this as much as I am. Now I can always say you helped me do that job in Kansas City. Our coincidental appearances would make it pretty hard for you to deny.
Yes, I guess it would at that.
So let's just bury the hatchet, huh? I still have to turn in the necklace, you know. We can go back to San Francisco in a couple of days.
Why not?
And after that, we can do the town together, baby. Have a lot of laughs. You know, I got a hunch this partnership could turn out okay.
Huh? I was just thinking the same thing, Frank. We'll just forget the past. Think only of the future.
All right. A bright future for both of us, sweetheart. If you play it smart.
Don't worry, Frank. I intend to play it smart.
It was a shock to find Frank Gilby on the train to Los Angeles after you thought you'd slipped away from him in San Francisco with the $30,000 all for yourself. But now he's on the train with you, and though he's agreed to an even split, you're certain he has plans to get the full $30,000 from you. And sitting beside him in the club car, you decide on a plan of your own, don't you, Eve? You listen attentively as Frank sips several highballs and continues to talk about your bright future as his partner. Sometime after midnight, the club car now deserted, except for you and Frank. You decide it's time to put your plan into action. You yawn, say goodnight, and leave Frank alone in the club car. Next morning, when the train pulls into Los Angeles, you will have the $30,000 safely tucked into your suitcase. And you're certain it's all yours. You're still confident as the police board the train, talk quietly to some of the passengers. Finally, the lieutenant comes around to you.
Yes, that's right, miss. According to the conductor, this man talked with you in the club car last night for quite a while.
Well, you say he fell off the train, lieutenant? How terrible. He seemed like such a nice young man, too.
You didn't know him before, I mean?
Well, no, I'd never even seen him. We chatted in the club car for a while, just train conversation.
Yeah, I see.
Hey, Lieutenant.
What? How do you reporters hear things so quick?
Oh, we got to keep our readers up on what's happening in our little old world. Come on, Lieutenant. I want this to hit the next edition. What's with this guy who fell off the train? Where'd it happen?
Just out of San Luis Obispo. And he didn't fall. He was pushed.
No.
Pushed?
Why, what makes you think that, Lieutenant?
Yeah, what's this all about?
The San Francisco police got a tip last night. Phone call from a woman about a payoff. A private investigator hired as a go-between was making a deal for the Perriman necklace. At a party, this woman said, killed a man in Kansas City.
Another killing?
Yeah. Looks like the investigator and the party that had the necklace agreed to meet on this train for the payoff. Quinn completed his part in the deal, all right, because when his body was found, the Perriman necklace was in his pocket.
Quinn?
Yes. The man who was pushed off the train. Leonard Quinn.
You mean the man I was talking to was a private investigator?
That's right.
Well, he told me his name was Frank Gilby.
Well, Quinn probably wanted to keep his identity covered until he'd completed the deal.
I see.
Quinn was the last person to leave the club car. The killer must have opened one of the outside doors between cars, then waited on the platform, and when Quinn came along, pushed him off the train.
Well, you think the killer who pushed Quinn off the train was a Kansas City killer, too?
Well, that's what the woman who tipped us off told us. Now, all we have to do is search the passengers and examine their luggage if necessary.
I get it. And if you find the 30 grand...
we'll have our killer. Oh, I'm sorry to bother you, miss, but as long as we're here, we might as well start with you.
Join us again next week when once again the United States Air Forces in Europe presents The Whistler. This is Air Force Sergeant Don Cormier speaking.
First heard on CBS, that was an Armed Forces Radio Service rebroadcast of The Whistler from the 6th of June, 1954. And that brings the curtain down on this hour of mystery on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for tuning in.